You're listening to the Tipton Children Podcast.
Okay, let's start with our motivation. So we've survived till this Thursday, which is actually something that was not at all certain, because between the time of our last teaching and the time of this teaching, many people have died. We could have easily been amongst them, but death did not happen yet. So we still have time to practice the Dharma and to use our Dharma practice to prepare for death. And so we want to make sure we use our time wisely, because all the preparations we make for having a good time in samsara, none of them are certain to happen. And all the preparation we make even for our old age is not certain to happen. But our future lifetime is certain. So it's strange how that's the one thing we don't prepare for, and yet we prepare for all these other things that may or may not happen. So let's prepare for our future lives and at the same time create the cause for liberation, create the cause for full awakening by having a very strong intention to practice ethical conduct, concentration, wisdom, bodhicitta. And to do this with the thought that cherishes others more than ourselves. So really including all other beings in our spiritual aspirations. And not just wanting to benefit them in this life, but really benefit them by showing them the path to be free of cyclic existence. So, I feel like I should do a Frank Sinatra song, or a Beatles song. Okay, so somebody wrote in a question, somebody who's been following the teachings from New Zealand, and so she said, in the last couple of months, I've been looking at precious human rebirth. I noticed there was a difference between what the Lamrim texts say are the causes for precious human rebirth and what precious garland does. Yeah, did anybody else notice that? Yeah, you noticed it. Okay. So Lamrim states ethical conduct. Yeah, these six far-reaching practices, and then dedication versus dedicating for a precious human life. And Precious Garland has the 13 practices to abandon and the 3 to practice. So they're not exactly the same. Okay, so what are the 13 to abandon? The 10 non-virtues, do you know what those are? Let's see. First? Okay, then?
Stealing.
Unwise and unkind sexual conduct.
Lying.
Divisive speech.
Harsh speech.
Idle talk.
covetousness,
maliciousness,
wrong view.
Okay, and what are the three extra ones?
Abstaining
from intoxicants. Abandoning wrong livelihood.
Disrespect for your teachers.
No, showing respect for those worthy of respect.
Yeah, that's on the three to practice. What's the other thing?
Not
harming others. Okay, so abandoning intoxicants, wrong livelihood, and harming others. And then three to practice.
Generosity.
Respecting those worthy of respect. And love. Okay. So how do those 16 match up with ethical conduct, the six perfections, and dedication? Do they?
Seems to me they're saying upper rebirth versus precious human rebirth.
No. He talked about upper rebirth, but it meant precious human life because it was in the context of we need a series of these in order to attain liberation and awakening. So the ethical conduct part's the same. Yeah? Okay. Then what? On one side we have the six perfections and dedication prayers. On the other side we have abandoning intoxicants, wrong livelihood, harming others, and practicing generosity, respecting others, and loving kindness. And they say that Lam Rim is rooted in Precious Garland. That Precious Garland is one of the source texts for Lam Rim. So, yeah?
But it sounds like they're just enumerating ethics in just a little bit different words.
Well, ethics is the main thing, but when you have the six perfections, ethics is one of them, generosity is one of them, we have generosity on the other side, but we also have fortitude, joyous effort, meditative stability, and wisdom. So, where are those on the other side?
I think to developing, able to develop respect to those worthy of respect and loving kindness, but you need some wisdom here to see that you are absolutely dependent, and also you have reduced your afflictions. That is with the support of insight.
Claire, say that again.
To be able to develop those respect for the worthy ones and love, you need to have reduced your own afflictions to develop it to its fullest, and the source of it is insight.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So to develop love and respecting for others, you need to reduce your afflictions, and wisdom is the way to do that. Okay, but they would also, you know, you can develop, what you said makes sense, definitely, yeah.
And to develop wisdom, you need the further far-reaching attitudes, so you need to go that path.
Yeah. But then where do all those far-reaching attitudes come from, the precious garland? You just said where wisdom came from, but what about the other ones? Yeah.
Well, it seems to me that the ones they say that the lay people should practice are generosity, ethics, and patience, and he's writing to a king, and he's at the level of precious human rebirth, and then we're going on to the higher states of liberation and awakening, and those things will follow.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Love is patience. I mean, fortitude anyway, so that's covered.
Yeah, we could say love, you know, corresponds with fortitude.
Yeah.
We could say that love also has to do with dedication.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. Dedicating the merit.
Yeah, properly.
We could say that.
Proper livelihood could be a joy separate, taking delight in the
virtuous. Proper livelihood is more on the side of ethical conduct. Okay, yeah.
Neither one, respecting those worthy of respect, kind of fits in also with the dedications.
How so?
Well, I guess that, because when we dedicate so often, we talk about we want to meet qualified spiritual mentors, we want to recognize them, follow their advice, you know.
Okay.
That ties up with respect.
Okay, so that having respect, respect could fit in. It is not equivalent to dedication, but it fits in because we do pray, you know, we do dedicate to meet qualified spiritual teachers and practice under them and so on. That's true. Yeah?
We also dedicate our merit for others, which is generosity.
Yeah, that's generosity. Okay. But what about, you know, not taking intoxicants? Where's that one fitting in?
That's ethical conduct.
That's ethical conduct. Not harming others. Yeah. Ethical conduct.
Meditative stability, never get intoxicated.
You notice that everyone who's come here who's had used substances for a long time,
they can't concentrate.
They can't, yeah. That's true. Okay, so in some way, abandoning intoxicants is related to meditative stability, because we and ethics, you know, because if you get intoxicated, then you do unethical things. And also, as we've noticed here, the people who come here who've been very heavy drug users, it's difficult for them to maintain their concentration, you know. Or, I mean, for alcohol users, too.
Yeah,
difficult to generate concentration. Okay, so we still kind of have fortitude floating around. And joyous effort.
Love
could have to do with maybe a little bit with joyous effort. Yes, it's the antidote to anger. Yeah, so love is the antidote to anger. Yeah.
Could you unpack that word, fortitude?
Fortitude. It's usually translated as patience. But patience in English means you're waiting for somebody. And that's not what this is about. This is about developing a very strong internal mind, you know, inside mind, that can bear suffering, that can bear criticism, you know, that has the internal strength to practice, you know, through hardship. So it's not just hanging around waiting for somebody.
Before you defined it, I was going to say that fortitude does make it sound like it's a part of joyous effort. It has to be a part of joyous effort.
It goes together with joyous effort, because fortitude, you know, gives you the stability to endure what's coming at you, and joyous effort gives you the energy to go and engage in all sorts of things. Yeah, they're related, definitely. Yeah. Okay. Huh? No, I'm asking you. Okay. So, so she just had some ideas about it, but I think our discussion kind of... Here's another question. Okay, let's see how you deal with this one. I've also been thinking about the environmental result of divisive speech, being born in a very hilly place or with cliff faces. Okay, and you can see, you know, divisive speech and cliffs and hills and unevenness. There's, you know, something about the state of the mind and the speech and the environment that it reflects. Okay. So Dunedin is very up and down, lots of beaches with cliffs, and it proclaims to have one of the steepest streets in the world. But this is proclaimed as part of the beauty of the place, what attracts people here. and also Nepal, the Himalayas, etc., they're not commonly viewed as a bad thing. Though a few days ago I did have some people complain to me that the hills prevented them from exercising. I can kind of see the logic of it, but less so than, say, the undesirableness of living in a muddy or dirty place that arises from sexual misconduct. Okay. So, so what do you think about that? I mean, why is it, why do they talk about the disadvantages of living in a hilly place with cliffs, but in Dunedin it's the beauty of the place?
Well, I would just think that it's not the only karma ripening for those people. So even though it might be steep or hilly, there's also beautiful climate, there's also the mind in which is in that rebirth that looks at this on one level. So there's a lot of different karmas ripening, not just steep and hilly and that could be a lot of things. It's not just one karma ripening.
Okay, so you're saying that the environment we lived in is actually the result of many different kinds of karma. Some may be the result of non-virtuous karma, and some the result of virtuous karma.
Like living here. We have lots of those here, but I wouldn't see this as a result of some negative karma.
Right, right, yeah. But if you're trying to grow farm and grow food, then having hills, you know, would be undesirable. Or steep cliffs also, you know, there's danger there. You know, if you're an agrarian society, you're trying to raise food and animals.
Mm-hmm. I saw it as a metaphor more than when you want to reach far with your voice, then the hill is a hindrance to reach further.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And it's also fine, these hills and cliffs, when we're young and fit. Or if we don't have any joint problems, but you know, any kind of breathing problems or mobility, and you can't go anywhere.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. I've been driving a bit recently for one of my jobs, and starting to think about speeding. It's breaking a law, but it's not naturally negative. Thinking of the motivation. Just even, oh, it won't hurt anybody, or everybody else is doing it, or I need to get somewhere quickly, doesn't seem to quite cover the potential harm you do if something went wrong. That 10 extra, you know, kilometers or miles per hour could mean somebody else dies in an accident as opposed to just getting hurt. So what do you think about speeding and breaking a law of speeding? Is it non-virtuous? Yeah?
I think it's rather self-centered. And anything that's totally self-centered is non-virtuous. Self-centered because it disregards the lives of others, like animals and things like that. Because if you're going at a decent speed, you can break for an animal, possibly. I mean, not that you would intentionally hit someone, but it's going to be, you know, it's like taking the extra care.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Like that. And people, too, also.
Yeah.
And yourself, in case that a tire blows out. If you're going, you know, whatever, 90 miles an hour, mm-hmm.
So not speeding is a good preventative measure, a precautionary measure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It also involves the harm of others, as opposed to yourself just getting where you want to go.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm late, I got to get here. Mm-hmm. Or I'm in a hurry, I want to get that extra thing. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's driving with the right speech also shows some concern for other sentient beings. Yeah. Uh-huh.
I'm obeying the laws of the land within reason, depending on the laws, shows some respect for harmony in society.
So obeying the laws of the land is showing respect and not wanting to harm others in society.
Respect for harmony.
Harmony. I thought it was here. Okay, so it shows respect for harmony. What about if there's a bad law?
Yeah.
Then what?
Oh, what?
Bad law.
Bad law.
Yeah.
I guess it would depend on how bad. I mean, it might just be...
You know, it's a negative to break the law, or, you know? Yeah.
I'm thinking that if you're driving mindfully of being careful, the specific speed, a certain speed is like really dangerous, but that if you're on the highway and the speed limit is 55, but everyone is going 65 or 70, in some ways it's more dangerous to be going 55 rather than going with
the traffic
flow.
Yes.
So I think whether it's legal or illegal or above or below the speed limit is that's a guideline, but that going with the way that the flow is going,
mm-hmm.
but being mindful of being safe at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, definitely another thing to be considerate of. Yeah, that if everybody else is going faster and you're going slow, it is more dangerous.
It's not in the textbook.
That's something.
She made the point that I just wanted to say John Meinhofer also echoed that point about how someone traveling 40 with a speed limit 65 is causing everyone to be late. That's very self-centered. So the judge says 80 is okay on the freeway, but not in town.
Oh, the judge says 80 is okay. We want to go to Hamburg when we get a speeding ticket. John, will you vouch for us?
Yeah, no, okay. Pay my ticket.
Speaking for the elderly, the right lane is for people who can't go as fast as everybody else. And so to have compassion for those who are actually driving within their capability because their reflexes aren't as fast and they don't see so well in the dark anymore,
mm-hmm.
I think. Thank you, John.
Here, you can say that. Okay. But these kinds of questions are really good, you know, because it shows somebody's thinking about the teachings. You know, they're not just listening and goes in one ear and out the other, but really thinking about them and, you know, how does it apply to, you know, how does it measure up with the Lamrim and, you know, these different things. So this is quite good. You know, this is the kind of thinking about the teachings and applying it to our lives that we should do. Yeah. Okay, shall we go on now? Okay, so we had just started verse 36 last time. So I just want to review what we did and then continue on. Okay, so verse 36 says, which with these three phases mutually causing each other, cyclic existence whirls around like the circle formed by a whirling torch, without beginning, middle, or end. Okay, so we had the three phases, the afflictions, which were of the 12 links, ignorance,
craving,
and clinging. Okay, then we had the two that were karmas, or actions. They were
formative action
and renewed existence. Sometimes renewed existence is translated as becoming, but becoming doesn't tell you anything. Renewed existence is that karma that is ready to ripen into whatever the next life is going to be. And then you have the seven results, which are often compacted just under birth, because once you're born in samsara, you know, once you take another birth, then all the other seven are a done deal. Okay, what are the others? These seven?
Consciousness.
Name and form.
Six
sense sources.
Contact.
Feeling.
Birth.
Aging and death. Okay. Okay, good. So, You know, he explained here how within each set of 12 links, when we're experiencing the results of one set of 12 links, we're creating the cause for new sets of 12 links. So the 12 links of dependent arising, there's the teaching by the Buddha showing how we get born in cyclic existence, starting with ignorance, then ignorance leading us to have afflictions out of which we create karma. The karma seeds are planted on the consciousness. Those ripen at the time of death when there's a lot of craving and clinging in the mind. That karma ripens and then throws us or propels us into another rebirth. Okay, once we're in the other rebirth, then we're creating more karma because of more ignorance. Yeah, so when we have the ignorance that doesn't know reality, we can create both destructive and constructive karma under the influence of that. Okay, so that the ignorance that doesn't know reality is itself not naturally negative; it's neutral. Okay, if it comes together with attachment, anger, jealousy, or the ignorance that doesn't know karma, that can't differentiate what's virtue and what's non-virtue, then that whole thing becomes non-virtuous karma. If still on the basis of self-grasping, you make offerings or you do some kind of dharma practice or you practice kindness or something like that, there's still the ignorance of the self-grasping, but we're creating virtuous karma. But that virtuous karma leads to rebirth and samsara. Okay? And so when we're generating renunciation by meditating on the 12 links, we're wanting out of samsara altogether. And the idea of having a precious human life next time is a stopgap measure, because we need lots of good rebirths in order to create all the causes necessary to attain liberation or full awakening. Okay? So if we really think about the 12 links of dependent arising very deeply, it gives us, we get this feeling like, wow, samsara is beginningless, it's endless, it's going nowhere, you know, for it has no ultimate purpose in it, and it's filled with dukkha, or unsatisfactory conditions. Okay, so we have the three unsatisfactory conditions. Do you remember those? First kind of dukkha? The dukkha of pain. Okay, so this is the ouch kind of dukkha that all sentient beings don't like. Okay, so just that alone can make you want to get out of samsara. However, when we don't experience that, then we forget about it and we get kind of lazy. Okay? What's the second kind of dukkha?
The dukkha of change.
The dukkha of change, okay? So what that is about is even the pleasant... The dukkha of change is what we call pleasant or happy feelings in samsara. And what pleasant or happy feelings about are is the pain of one negative feeling has gone down, but the pain of a new circumstance has yet to arise. So that fits in with what you were saying, you know, in the things that you enjoy. So, yeah. So you want to take an example and we'll look at how it's changeable,
yeah.
Dukkha?
Thanksgiving dinner.
Okay.
Which comes to mind, first of all.
Okay, so Thanksgiving dinner. So Thanksgiving dinner, you know, everybody thinks, oh, Thanksgiving dinner, then how wonderful, the whole family's there, and you're eating turkey and mashed potatoes and gravy and apple pie, you're being all American, You know, they're even playing a taped Red Sox game. Football.
Football is Thanksgiving.
Oh, football is Thanksgiving. So forget the Red Sox. Okay, which football team?
Patriots.
Patriots. Okay. I knew it wasn't. I don't care. So the Patriots are playing on Thanksgiving, and the snow is falling, and you're together with your family, and the mind says that is the epitome of happiness. Yeah? Okay. Right? And, you know, they talk about it in the movies, and, you know, what before Thanksgiving, all the advertising, and, you know, the little children making, you know, biscuits with mom, and, you know, all that kind of stuff, okay? So how is that the dukkha of change?
When you start eating, and then you sit down to eat, and it's like, yeah, and then you keep on eating.
Okay, so you're hungry because you were working all day. You had to polish the silverware because company was coming over. And you had to clean out the china plates that haven't been used since last year because company's coming over. Okay, do you remember that? Oh. It's interesting how certain things from our childhood are just like, we all had the same kind of thing.
If you had silver.
Yes, otherwise it's paper plates. Sometimes you have the china and the silverware, but you use the paper plates and plastic spoons anyway. Okay. Okay, so you're hungry because you didn't eat all day because you were cooking. So when you start to eat, you know, there's the unpleasantness of the hunger. When you start to eat, the pleasure of, you know, the removal of hunger, you know, is you're having the removal of hunger, and the suffering of eating, the pain of eating, is still very small. Okay? So the uncomfortableness of hunger is down. The uncomfortableness of eating is very small, and that's what we call happiness or pleasure. Okay? If it were true happiness or pleasure, the more you ate, the happier you would be. Okay? So you keep eating. And the eating, the suffering of eating, gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Doesn't it? Yeah. Until at the end of Thanksgiving dinner, what are you doing? You're holding your belly going, oh, I ate too much. Okay. If eating were really, real, true happiness, then the more you ate, the happier you should be. But that's not what happens. Okay. So similarly, the more you watch the Patriots play, the happier you should be. Yeah?
But provided they're winning.
That's the thing, provided they're winning. What happens if they're not winning? And what happens if you just watch one football game after another, after another, after another? After a while, it's like...
Yeah. enough of this.
Yeah.
I mean, sci-fi movie.
Yeah, and then you watch the sci-fi movies, and then after a while, if those were real happiness, the more sci-fi movies you watched, the happier you would be. But what happens then? Yeah, you get a headache, you know.
It's time to get up and go outside.
Yeah, and you want to go out. Then you go outside and it's cold. Yeah. So then you have the unpleasantness of cold, you come back inside, you say, oh, this is so wonderful, it's warm, yeah, but then it becomes too warm, yeah. Somebody's turned the heat way up, because they want the cats to be warm. I won't say who. Yeah, so we see that whatever we do in cyclic existence, none of these things in and of themselves are actual causes of happiness. Because if they were, the more you did them, the happier you would be. But actually, in fact, the more you do them, at a certain point, it's like, ugh, you know, it turns into active suffering and misery. Okay? And then the third, yes, what's the third one?
Pervasive
condition, the dukkha of pervasive conditioning. Okay, what this means is that we are under the influence of afflictions and karma. Yeah, that our whole lives are ruled by ignorance, afflictions, and karma. That we aren't free. Yeah, we're bound. Yeah. We think in the West that we're free. Yeah, freedom means I can go to the mall anytime I want to. Yeah, or I can watch anything I want to on the computer. You know, that's not real freedom because usually our mind is bound. Yeah, real freedom is when the mind is free, when there's no self-centeredness, ignorance, anger, attachment in the mind. That's real freedom, you know. Otherwise, when we're reacting to the environment or, you know, running around trying to get pleasure, our mind is not free. Okay? So they say that for the, that all sentient beings don't like the dukkha of pain, and that spiritual practitioners of most traditions see through the dukkha, the unsatisfactoriness of change, and think there's got to be something more than this. But only in the Buddhist tradition do people see through the pervasive conditioned dukkha, you know, to really see that how ignorance is running our lives and keeping us bound in samsara. Okay, and bound in samsara means taking one set of polluted aggregates after the other. Polluted being aggregate body and mind taken under the influence of afflictions and karma. Okay? Kendra, yeah?
So the first two are pretty much the result of the third, aren't
they? Yeah. Yeah. The third one also has to do... The third one also means that even when things are going well, you're actually walking on the edge of the cliff, not realizing you're on a cliff. Because things are well, but at any moment, you know, even a small circumstance could change anything, and there you go off the cliff into overt the dukkha pain. Yeah? Okay, I mean, that's what happened to you a few days ago. Yeah, you're having a very nice day. Then suddenly your heart starts going mad, palpitating, and you wind up in ER. Yeah? So, you know, thought that everything was great, you know. And when, you know, when everything seems to be going along, we get quite complacent. We don't think anything's happened. We're walking right there on the edge of the cliff, but we don't even realize it. I mean, that's the extent of our ignorance. So Kenzo Rinpoche here says something quite nice. He said that, you know, how important it is to contemplate the first and second of the four truths for the Aryas, you know, the true dukkha and the true origin of dukkha. And then he says, on the other hand, if we do not contemplate the defects of samsara and clearly understand its roots, we are like a pig being chased by a dog. When the dog bites its backside, the pig knows it has a problem and squeals. But the rest of the time, it lives at ease. Okay? So it is like that, you know? Okay. So we talked already about the difference between the determination to be free and the aspiration to attain liberation. The determination to be free wants to get us out of samsara. The aspiration for liberation wants to get us to nirvana. So we need both of those, actually. And then also contemplating the 12 links increases our compassion for other sentient beings because we realize that, you know, they're in the same situation as we are, you know, especially with those three kinds of dukkha, you know, creating karma again and again and again for more and more rebirths without any choice, without any freedom. And especially when you look around and you see that most people, they aren't even aware of being in samsara. I mean, you say samsara to them and they say it's a perfume. No, yeah. Yes, yeah. Samsara is the perfume, nirvana is the band. Okay. But, you know, that's what they think samsara is, you know. And they don't question, you know, why do I have this body? Why am I born me? Who am I anyway? Yeah. There's no questioning about that. What they question is, you know, did the stock market go up or down today? You know, that's what they're questioning. Did the Patriots win or lose?
Fortunately, they're not playing yet.
Okay. So, you know, that's the kind of questions that people investigate. And meanwhile, the very basic questions about the nature of life, you know, what are the causes of happiness and suffering? They don't ask. They assume they know. Causes of happiness, money. Causes of suffering, other people. Yeah? And you know, no awareness of or examination of their situation. No wish to they want to avoid the dukkha of pain, but everything else is like, meh. You know, I just hope it turns out well. So when you look at people, especially people who have precious, who have human lives, maybe they don't have a precious human life, but they have a human life, and you think of everything they could do with their human life, and then they don't even care about the situation they're in. You know, they don't see it as a hellhole. They only want to, you know, well, let's get as much pleasure as I can and hope death comes long, long time or somehow they'll, you know, there will be an exception for me and I won't die. Which means that then you have to live with a body that's 100 years old or 200 years old or 500 years old, which doesn't sound really appetizing either, does it? Okay. So, you know, it's really important to contemplate these 12 links of dependent arising and generate the wish to attain liberation and to increase our compassion. Okay, then one thing to clarify here, you know, because we talk about bodhisattvas being born in samsara for the benefit of others. And sometimes it's said that bodhisattvas give up their own nirvana in order to be reborn in samsara for the benefit of others. So we have to really understand some things here. First of all, there's different levels of bodhisattvas. Yeah, the higher level bodhisattvas who have realized emptiness directly, who know the nature of reality directly, they have control over the rebirth process. The lower level bodhisattvas, the ones on the paths of accumulation, paths of preparation, they don't have control over the rebirth process. Yeah, they create a lot of good karma. You know, so hopefully due to that creation of so much good karma, they'll get a good rebirth, but they can't consciously control it because they haven't realized emptiness yet. Okay. Then among the Aryas who have realized emptiness, who do have that control, if you're a Bodhisattva Arya, if you're a hearer or solitary realizer Arya, you know, you're just focused on liberation and that, you know, like, let's get out of here as fast as I can. The Bodhisattva Aryas are focused on being they're focused on attaining full awakening for the benefit of all beings. Okay? So, there's a couple of things. If they're practicing the perfection vehicle, they need to create a lot of merit to attain full awakening. How do they create merit? They have to reappear in our world and do especially the first three of the six perfections, practicing generosity, ethical conduct, fortitude. In other words, all these things by which you create a lot of merit. So they have to appear in the world to do that, to create the merit to become fully awakened. And they also appear in this world to benefit sentient beings, because that's their whole reason for doing anything. So when we say that they're born in samsara for the benefit of sentient beings, they don't think that they're born in samsara under the influence of afflictions and karma, because they're not. Because these Arya Bodhisattvas, you know, have realized emptiness directly, so the afflictions and karma, while they're not free of it until they attain the eighth bodhisattva ground, still they're not controlled by it in the sense of being born in samsara by afflictions and karma. Instead, they're born in samsara by the power of their prayers and by the power of unpolluted karma. Okay? It also, the fact that they get born in our world, we say they're born in samsara, but actually, they're, you know, samsara means the five aggregates, so they don't really have the five, these Aryas don't have the five aggregates like we have. They make certain emanations that look like human beings and act like human beings, but aren't human beings. And it's through all these emanations and doing, you know, benefiting sentient beings in all sorts of ways by making these bodies and, you know, benefiting sentient beings that they create so much merit, which makes them able to, you know, eliminate greater and greater levels of afflictions until they attain full awakening. Okay? So it's not that bodhisattvas don't attain awakening. Okay, and it's not that they give up their awakening for the benefit of sentient beings, because they can see that if they attain full awakening, they'll have all the qualities necessary to be of the greatest benefit to sentient beings, and that's their wish. Yeah. But they also know that, you know, if they were to not attain full awakening and just stay in samsara, even if it's for the benefit of sentient beings, they wouldn't be able to benefit others as much as they would if they were able to attain full awakening. So they still are aimed and going towards full awakening, but they will manifest in this world to create the causes for that full awakening. Okay? So it doesn't mean that they give up their own enlightenment, their own awakening. Okay, it's important to understand because there's a lot of confusion about this. Yeah. Okay. Verse 37. We're moving along here. Okay. So 37, 38 come together. But the process of cyclic existence is not attained from itself, from something else, or from both, nor is it attained in the three times. Okay, therefore, for one who knows this, the eye-grasping ceases, and hence also karma and birth. Seeing in this fashion the arising of effect from cause, and also seeing its cessation, the wise think the world is ultimately neither existent nor non-existent. Okay. So the process of cyclic existence, it doesn't come about, you know, it's not caused from itself, from something, from other, from both. Here he doesn't put the fourth option, causelessly, but he puts the one, nor is it attained in the three times. Okay? So Nagarjuna and Precious Garland, he gives many different kinds of reasonings to refute inherent existence. So here's this one, you know. He only put three, but, you know, it has all four, being produced from self, others, both, and causelessly. And that's also the theme of his the first verse of the Karikas, where he said, neither from itself, nor from another, nor from both, nor without a cause, does anything anywhere ever arise. Okay? So this refutation, this particular tetralemma with the four options, is very, very famous, and you spend, I don't know how much time discussing it and debating it, you know, when you're studying doing the Madhyamaka class. So production or arising from self means that the result is already existent in the cause. Okay? And sometimes we think like that, you know? Or there's people around who think like that. Yeah? The result's already there in the cause. It just has to manifest. So it's kind of, it's almost like predetermination in some ways. Yeah? And there was an ancient school in India, the Sankhyas, and they asserted this kind of arising. So they said, you know, inside the seed you have the sprout just has to manifest. Yeah. So the Buddhists debate them and say, you know, if there's a lot of debates, you know, because then cause and effect exist at the same time. If the effect is there in the cause and effect exist at the same time. They never exist at the same time, do they? The cause has to cease for the result to arise. But on a practical level, you know, then when, okay, because food is the cause of kaka, or in that kaka is what they say in Tibetan, shit, in English. Excuse my, I can't say French anymore. Excuse my. Actually, one of the Tibetan translators was translating for His Holiness, and you know, people had been teaching him English, and you know, and he said something, you know, instead of, you know, a refined word like excrement or feces, he said, you know, translating for His Holiness, he said shit, and all the English speaking people went, wow. And then I remember one time, instead of bowl, he said bowel. Yeah, but he was otherwise, he was quite a good translator. Okay, so, you know, otherwise you would say that, you know, the poo-poo. What do you call it for little children? Poo-poo. Okay, so your poo-poo is in the food. So you're eating poo-poo. Yeah? So if things were caused by, you know, were caused by self and the effect were in the cause, then that's what would be happening. that doesn't make any sense. Okay, so we throw out that side. Then the next one is that it's caused from other. This one is actually, you say, well, yeah, you know, the sprout is caused by a seed, and the seed is something other than the sprout. And the cake is caused by the flour and the butter, which are things that are other than it. So what's wrong with this one being produced by, you know, arising from other? What it means here is not just any other. It means an other substance or thing that is inherently existent. Okay? So it would mean that the cake is produced by inherently existent flour, inherently existent butter, inherently existent bananas. I'm dropping hints. Inherently existent nuts, inherently existent raisins. Oh, she's just typing. So when it just says other, it's meaning inherently existent other. So if the ingredients of the cake were inherently existent, inherent existence means independent existence. Means that something exists in and of itself. It doesn't depend on anything else. Something that is independent of everything else cannot change. Because things change because they're affected by other things in the universe. They're affected by causes and conditions. Inherently existent things, if they existed, would not be affected by anything. In which case, actually, you couldn't make a cake because the flour and the butter and the bananas and so forth would never change. They couldn't change to make a cake. Okay? So things aren't produced by an inherently existent other. So there were, again, schools in ancient India where they asserted that. Even the lower Buddhist schools, they say that things are produced by an inherently existent other. Then the Jains said that things are produced by both self and other, okay? And they gave the example of a pot because it's produced from itself because it's made of clay, and it's produced from other because you need the potter, okay? But the Buddha, you know, the Prasangikas say back to them, that doesn't work because if it's produced by self and other, then you have the defects of it being produced by self, and you also have the defects of it being produced for other, and we've just refuted both of those options. So things aren't, you know, they don't arise from both self and other. And then the fourth option is causelessly, and we all know things don't arise without causes. Okay, because there would just be total chaos, you know. If things arose without causes, then farmers wouldn't plant seeds, you know, to grow their crops. We wouldn't eat meals to stop our hunger. We wouldn't build houses to protect ourselves because things would happen without any causes. Okay. So again, there was an ancient Indian school, the Travakas, who said that. And you talk, you know, sometimes you talk to people now who kind of have that idea. You know, when you talk about randomness, yeah, sometimes people say, yeah, it's just total randomness. There's no cause and effect. But that's not exactly like that, because then things would be totally chaotic. Okay, So he's saying that the process of cyclic existence, these 12 links, okay, they don't come about because they're not produced from self, not from other, not from both, not from causelessly, and they're also not produced in the three times. They don't arise in the three times. Okay? So what does that mean, they don't arise in the three times? Yeah? Surely, you know, we say, well, yeah, samsara was in the past, it's in the present, it's in the future. Yeah. But what does that actually mean? Can you identify any of the three times? Can you isolate them? Yeah, because all three times you know, are posited in dependence upon the present. Yeah, the past is something has existed and it's gone out of existence. The future is something that has yet to exist. You know, everything's posited in terms of the present existing moment. But can you identify the present moment? Yeah, where is the present moment? This is something really interesting to sit with. Yeah. Because we're always saying, live in the present moment, live in the present moment. Where is the present moment? Can you show me the present moment? As soon as we want to point to something as the present moment, it's the past moment, isn't it? Yeah. And if we say, well, no, it's not the past moment, it's the moment that's just about to come. But the moment that's just about to come is the future moment. Where's the moment that's happening right now? Well, it's right now. But right now, yeah, has a certain, right now is like gone, isn't it? And even if you could delineate a right now, wouldn't it also have if you could define a moment, yeah, wouldn't it also have a beginning, middle, and end? Yeah. So then the moment has a beginning and middle and end. So which is the present moment? The beginning part of it, the middle part of it, or the end part of it? Well, the middle part of it. Well, then, doesn't the middle part of it also have a beginning, middle, and end? Yeah? What are you going to point to as the present moment? Okay? So it gets a little dicey here. I wonder why. That should have been mentioned in this paragraph here. Huh. He didn't explain that in depth here. Okay, then it says, okay, so samsara doesn't arise in any of those ways. Therefore, for someone who knows this, so to know what we just explained, that person has to understand emptiness. They have to understand dependent arising. So for somebody who knows that, the eye grasping has ceased. I, this kind of I, not this one, the I, the me grasping. Okay? If we've ceased the I grasping, then the afflictions and the polluted karma that cause rebirth have also ceased. Okay? So if we know that things aren't produced by self, other, both, causelessly, and they aren't produced in the past, present, and future, then, you know, we have insight into the nature of reality that overcomes the ignorance that creates samsara. Okay? So seeing in this fashion the arising of effect from causes and also seeing its cessation, the wise think the world is ultimately neither existent nor non-existent. Okay, so when you see effects arising from causes, and you also see that when the cause is missing, the effect can't come into being. In other words, when you eliminate ignorance, then you eliminate the second link of karma. Yeah, then you eliminate all the other links that follow after that. Okay, so you begin to understand, you know, how we get reborn and how to cease rebirth. And you are understanding the nature of reality, you know, the unity of dependent arising, or the complementary character of dependent arising and emptiness. And then you think the world is ultimately neither existent nor non-existent. Now we go, wait a minute, something's got to be either existent or non-existent. What do you mean it's not either one of them? Okay, here you have to insert some words, okay, because when we talk about the two extremes, yeah, the two extremes are inherent existence and total non-existence. So here, Nagarjuna shortens it. He just says existence and non-existence. So if you don't understand that what he's meaning is inherent existence and total non-existence, then you get into this thing, well, nothing either exists or it doesn't exist. And so things are inconceivable. You know, they neither exist nor they don't exist. Therefore, we don't have a position. You know, what Guy got into on the weekend about this, all this fussiness of misunderstanding. Okay? So when he says the world is ultimately neither existent nor non-existent, what he means is it's not inherent existence and it's not totally non-existent. Okay? But you can see that for the people who ask the Buddha the question, does the world exist or non-exist, not exist? If they're thinking in terms of inherent existence, how can he answer that question? Because if he says, yes, the world exists, then they think, oh, it inherently exists, which is incorrect. If he says the world doesn't exist, then they think nothing exists. That's detrimental also. So he's stuck with not being able to answer the question. Okay. I think I'm going to have to insert something more here. Yeah, because Kenzo Rinpoche didn't go into it not being attained in the three times. I'm reading from the manuscript of a book, okay, that hasn't yet been published. Okay, so that's it for this evening. Yeah, and then next week we'll continue with all the people who are afraid to hear what Nagarjuna just said. There's a lot of them, too. Any remaining questions? Yeah.
Just on this tonight, I hope this is part of it. I couldn't figure out what this weekend. Here's, we got Bhagavad Baker reading Nagarjuna, and we just marinated ourselves in the Aryadeva, and never the word permanent came up. Like, his ideas that of having some character in the conventionally existent that would have to be permanent.
If things existed by their own characteristics, yes, they would have to be permanent.
Yeah, so because he's so interested in Nagarjuna and...
Who's he?
Bhava
Vaika. Uh-huh.
And then Aryadeva just, you know, when we went through that, even Venerable Doctor and I was talking about this, that word, that never came up in...
Permanent?
Yeah.
Oh, even there was a whole chapter about impermanence.
Not in anything that we covered this weekend.
Oh, okay. But in the 400 stanzas... Yeah, the 400 stanzas spoke a lot.
Why that doesn't come up in even the... Any
of
the, discussion this weekend, that whole issue never came up once.
If Bhava Viveka is saying that things exist inherently on the conventional level,
right,
then why doesn't somebody say then they would be permanent?
Why wouldn't he have that idea?
That then they would be permanent.
And it doesn't even come up in the discussion.
Yeah. Well, this is, you know, this is the tricky thing about... You know, because Bhava Viveka never said outright, I believe in inherent existence on the conventional level. Mm-hmm. He never said that outright. So he said all these other things, and then people kind of said, well, he must assert inherent existence on the conventional level. I'm sure if he had thought about it, you know, would he even have said, I assert inherent existence on the conventional level? He probably wouldn't have even said that. Yeah? So if indeed he did think that, it probably wasn't something conscious in his mind because, he was a great sage. He probably would have realized the faults in that already. Yeah? That's how I would explain it. Yeah, I mean, it seems like with a lot of things on the debating ground, you say something, and when you say it, it seems like it's really right and it's really true. And then somebody says something that contradicts you, and at first you're like, wait a minute, that can't be. And then you think about it, and it's like, oh yeah, I didn't think my position through correctly. Because if I would have, I would have seen that, yeah, of course, this other thing would have had to be too.
I'm wondering why doesn't this, in the four reasons of from self or from other, why he doesn't list neither? He doesn't list neither in the verse.
Causeless.
Oh, neither is the causeless one.
Right.
Yeah. So you could say self, other, both, or neither. But they usually, instead of say neither, they say causeless.
Does he say causeless? He's wondering why they didn't list causelessly,
or
neither.
Yeah. Oh, why he didn't list it here? I don't know.
I still struggle a lot with meditating on the 12 commandments of the Pali origination. Like often it gets very intellectual or abstract. It's not having that kind of...
Yeah. Okay, so the meditation on the 12 links seems quite intellectual. You need it to... Yeah.
Recalling terms and
to yeah. I think I find it more helpful to really, instead of going 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 like that, because it's hard to understand that way, how it affects your life. But if you think, you know, karma, if you think ignorance, karma, and then craving and clinging and renewed existence and birth, then, you know, and you think this is my experience. And then, you know, you think of some action you did that either, you know, virtuous, it's more often more effective if you think of a harmful action you did. And just follow the steps. Okay, you know, I told somebody off because I was jealous or I was angry or whatever it was. You know, so there was ignorance. You know, there was my jealousy or anger. I spoke those words. The words are the second link formative action. Yeah. And you remember the specific situation. You think, okay, that situation's over, yeah, but I spoke those words with a negative intention, and the residual energy of that, the seed of the karma, you know, the action stopped, but the seed of the karma continued, and that's, you know, on my mind stream. And I haven't purified it yet. Yeah, I said that with real determination. I wasn't messing around. I was really mad. Yeah, I rejoiced after I said it. You know, I want to tell that person off more. Yeah, and now what's going to happen at the time I die, you know, if I'm sitting there dying and, you know, this negative karma ripens. Maybe I'm a little bit irritated when I'm dying. And that acts to fertilize that seed of the negative karma, you know, and I'm craving to maintain this body and I can't do it, so I'm clinging to have another body. And then that karma from telling that person off ripens. And then my mind, you know, is attracted to, you know, what kind of birth? I don't know, some kind of birth where there's a lot of loud noises and harsh speech all around. Now, and you think, you know, this is what it means to create karma and experience the result. And that's, you know, what can happen to me. Or think about this life. How did I get this life? It didn't come out of nowhere. Yeah, so there were lots of causes created in the past. Yeah, but there was also craving and clinging at the end of my last life that ripened, you know, all those different karmas. And then my mind, you know, completely, you know, I have no memory of it at all, you know. All of a sudden, boing, you're in a new rebirth, propelled by afflictions and karma, and there you are. Yeah, so really think, you know, this is, why was I born me? Well, this is why. And, you know, what are my actions doing now? This is the kind of result that they're going to bring in the future.
Are you saying that the high-level bodhisattvas, you know, when they get, they come to samsara, I mean, they don't come to samsara, but when they take birth to benefit sentient beings, they don't have the five aggregates like samsaric?
Okay, so the Arya bodhisattvas, yeah, they don't have that. They have what's called a mental body. Yeah, it's a body that's the nature of mind. So their, you know, their form aggregate isn't really like ours. They can make it so it looks like ours, but it's not really.
But Shakyamuni, when he was
Okay, so Shakyamuni Buddha is. There we're not just talking about the Arya Bodhisattvas, there we're talking about a fully awakened Buddha. So there we have, for the Buddhas, we have the Buddha bodies, you know, and one of them is the emanation body. So Shakyamuni Buddha was an emanation body.
So he wasn't subjected to the three types of suffering?
No. From the Mahayana viewpoint, you know, he wasn't subject to the three kinds of dukkha. Yeah. From the Pali viewpoint, they because from the Mahayana viewpoint, we say he was already a Buddha, and that was an emanation body that was manifest for the benefit of sentient beings. The Pali tradition say when the Buddha was born, he was still on the path of preparation, so he was an ordinary being, you know, and then he became a Buddha. And then, when he attained parinirvana, the aggregates and the consciousness ceased. That's next week's verse. Mm-hmm. What happens when the Buddha attains parinirvana?
So, when you're talking about Arya Bodhisattva, are you talking about manifesting a mental body? Are you talking about the bodhisattvas on the eighth bhumi and above?
No, it's the path of seeing and above.
Because. I've heard
you know,
different things.
Yeah. They usually say from path of seeing onwards that they have a mental body. Yeah. There may be different things in different solemn texts. Okay.